Hello everyone, herb lovers, sustainable health seekers, herbal medicine fans. Welcome back to Herbcast, our podcast from Herbal Reality. In every episode, we explore how traditional wisdom and up-to-date herbal science can meet the needs of the hour and support a sustainable and effective approach to our health. As you know, herbs have nourished human health for thousands of years, and whilst they hold so much potential to meet today's numerous health challenges, there are still so many questions to be answered. And we're delighted to have you with us today as we continue to deepen our understanding together. So get comfy, pour yourself a cup of herbal tea, and let's begin. Today's episode is hosted by Marion McConaughey.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Herbcast. Today I'm going to be talking to Kate Siraj about a healthy herbal pregnancy, the Ayurvedic way. Now, Kate is an Ayurvedic practitioner, shadow work facilitator, and co-founder of the Ayurveda Academy. Kate, really lovely to have you on the show.
Oh, lovely to be here.
So we're going to be talking about an Ayurvedic approach to women's health, and particularly fertility and pregnancy. I've learned a little bit about Ayurveda over the years, particularly while working at Pucker Herbs. But it feels like Ayurveda's really gained in popularity over the last few years, partly through an association with yoga, I think, and also partly as the idea of being able to personalise health simply using the doshas is quite an attractive one. But whenever I've looked into Ayurvedic principles in more depth, I've realised it's a lot more complicated. So what first inspired you to study Ayurveda?
Well, I did chemistry for my first degree, so a quite different approach, and then went into sort of the corporate world and was doing sort of marketing management stuff like that, which I found great. It was really exciting, and there was lots of sort of ambition and let's get this and, you know, all that kind of thing, paid well, all that stuff. But at some point I realized that it really wasn't making my heart sing. There was something about purpose that wasn't really connecting. And I did quite a lot of voluntary work through a leadership trust. And through that, it was also exploring, like, what do you love? What do you really love? And so what I just realized I loved was actually just being with people and helping them in some way feel some peace. So I knew I wanted to go into something like that. And it was a matter of then, okay, I think health is probably the way. And I'd been brought up in a house where there was sort of a bit of homeopathy here and sort of a bit here and there. So holistic medicine was already kind of on the cards. But also the home that I grew up in had featured a lot of Vedic knowledge. So it was, there was a lot of meditation and all mindfulness exercise and things, which when I was a child were deeply embarrassing. But now are like kind of mainstream and everyone loves. So I already had that sort of Vedic understanding of the world in me. So it kind of made sense to go down the Ayurvedic route. And I had quite a lot of friends as well who'd actually seen Ayurvedic practitioners and had really good results. So I started reading some books on it, and I was really inspired. And so then went, did another degree. And so that degree was in Ayurveda. And that's where I met Jo. You mentioned Pucker Herbs. Jo used to work there, and she and I now run the Ayurveda Academy together. So we go way back to then as well. I did that degree, and then eventually started practicing with a few children thrown in between.
It's a good thing to have that knowledge and understanding while you're raising your own family as well. I think it helps for empowerment.
Yes.
So thinking about Ayurveda and women's health, sort of how is it useful to apply an Ayurvedic approach to women's health, and particularly things like fertility?
It's important for all health, in my opinion, but of course I would be saying that. Yeah. I think for women in particular, we have a whole lot of extra sort of cyclical stuff that happens with us that men don't. And to understand even just that from an Ayurvedic point of view is really helpful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in and of itself, just as a human being, Ayurveda can help with understanding yourself, staying in balance, really kind of getting a sense of what's the right place for me, what's out of balance for me. But then when it comes to women, being able to sort of see your cycle through an Ayurvedic way. So at certain points in the cycle, different elements are more predominant. So we see those in terms of dosha. You mentioned that earlier, but these are sort of basically combinations of elements. And so there'll be times in the month where we might want to be resting more. We might want to be changing our diet slightly. And so just even things like that, really understanding ourselves from an elemental point of view and where we are in our cycle is really useful.
So is it that each stage of the cycle has a more predominant dosha, for example, and an approach to sort of increasing or decreasing the doshas? Or I'm going to very crudely explain this. Which doshas are particularly predominant and which parts of the cycle then?
Yeah, so the during menstruation itself, Vata is more predominant. Vata is the air and space dosha. Mm-hmm. And so that's really a time when you want to be more restful, and where Vata can go out of, more likely to go out of balance. So when a particular dosha is more predominant during a phase, you just need to kind of be a bit more watchful for it. So it's almost like the pot that's already quite full and could then start to overflow if you weren't to manage that. And then it moves into the kapha stage of the cycle, which is earth and water based. That's the sort of, what you know, the stage pre-ovulation, so and up to ovulation. So you're kind of feeling maybe there's quite a lot of energy, there's quite a lot of resilience at that point. You know, you feel like the world is your oyster, you can do all sorts of things. And then after ovulation, and then prior to menstruation, during the luteal phase, then you'll have pitta beginning to dominate more. So that's the fire and water element dosha. And so that's a time when, you know, naturally you might start to feel maybe that little bit more irritable or hungry, and that's quite normal. And therefore to maybe you need to eat more, for example. Mm. And so that's sort of just like a normal page part of the cycle, rather than going, oh God, why am I so hungry now? This is, you know, I must stop, you know, this is too much. And actually it's like, oh no, this is just a stage. And then when I'm potentially in the Vata stage or the Kapha stage, maybe I won't eat so much, and that's totally normal. Mm-hmm. So that's how the cycle looks. And of course you can have imbalances in any of those doshas at any point, and that will start to show itself as well.
Yeah. So it sounds like Kapha is the bit when you're building up and consolidating and getting strong. Does that mean that kapha would be high, say, in pregnancy, for example? What happens when someone's pregnant?
The ideal, yes, is that we have more kapha during our pregnancy. That is the way, or every single bit of advice that we give during pregnancy is to kind of build up kapha and to reduce vata and pitta. Mm. So we're not talking about constitutions. Constitution you have, you can't do anything about it. It's just what's happening now for you, any imbalance or so on. So if you have some vata imbalance, which you know, might be getting, you know, constipation or anxiety or restlessness or things like that, you'd want to bring that down, and then you want kapha to rise, because it's kapha that, as you say, builds you up, gives you strength, nourishes the tissues. And obviously while we're pregnant, we're growing a whole baby, we're growing our own tissues are growing, our blood is increasing, our you know, the plasma is increasing. So we want to be doing everything we can to sort of nourish. There's a big focus during particularly, well, all pregnancy, but particularly in those early months, of really increasing kapha. So it could be having some really good quality milk, ghee, which is a real favorite during pregnancy, and in Ayurveda in general, but in pregnancy it's really important. So yeah, kind of how you can make the body in a way sort of more moist, more nourished. Yeah.
And is there ever a danger of someone who, say, is very constitutionally kapha and then is pregnant and is supporting their kapha, having too much of that, for example, and having to
take? Yeah, that could happen. Yeah, absolutely. And it probably, hopefully, would be advised not to go completely overboard on supporting the kapha. You know, if you were seeing an Ayurvedic practitioner, or you were aware through your own understanding of Ayurveda, you'd be like, I don't think that's going to be a problem for me. You know, I can just nourish myself well, but I don't need to, you know, go overboard and I'm taking like liters of milk and ghee each day. Whereas someone like me, for example, who I've got a Vata Pitta constitution, I'd need to really sort of like, okay, how could I build this up? But yes, if you were already quite kapha and you had more kapha, you know, you were kind of overdoing that, you could end up with more water retention, for example, or just really sluggish, the energy dips, feeling that you're sort of foggy and all those kind of things that could happen.
Can you tell me about a specific case when you were successfully treated someone with fertility or women's health issues?
The one that comes to mind is a client who had severe endometriosis, really debilitating. Eventually actually had to have various parts of the body removed, and including one of the ovaries and things, but other things as well. So she just wanted to manage her condition, but actually very shortly then wanted to conceive as well, and had been told that she had less than a 1% chance of conception. So I do make sure I don't overpromise. You know, I think it's really important not to, and say, look, we can support you in every way we can, and let's go there. So, and this was a client who was really willing to really go for the things that I was suggesting, and that's not necessarily easy when you're in an extreme situation like that. We were talking about really looking at it from an emotional point of view. So that's where my shadow work side really comes in. And from a deep cleansing Ayurvedic point of view, where we want to do more of the purgation sort of cleansing type techniques we call Shodhana. My suggestion was, okay, let's deep dive on the emotions, and let's deep dive in terms of physical cleansing. She was up for both. And I think, you know, that hence she did really well. She conceived and had a healthy baby, and, wonderful, you know, really heartwarming sort of story. But she chose to take it all on as well. Obviously there were other parts of that as well, in terms of, you know, looking at diet and lifestyle and herbs, obviously. But I think sometimes with fertility, depending on the extremity, you do need to, in my opinion, go with some of the more sort of extreme or deeper processes. But if someone's just, you know, has been trying for 6 months and hasn't yet, that would not necessarily be doesn't need to be quite the same. But from an emotional point of view, I mean, Charaka, who is one of the founding fathers of Ayurveda, he says that, you know, happiness is essential for conception, and which also can be translated as lack of worries. And, you know, I think that's a major thing in our life at the moment. You know, there is a lot of stress and lots of sort of things going on within people's lives. So I think that's a really major component, which I think is being more and more accepted now. People are understanding that, you know, that that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. So you use a combination of herbs and diet and shadow work then, presumably. Are there other sort of specific Ayurvedic techniques that you can use?
Yeah, so for example, with this case, I used something called Vidachana, which is a purge. So it's one of the Panchakarma techniques, which are 5 techniques which we use for deep cleansing. And so that involves, it's not necessarily the most pleasant thing, but it really works. It's really useful for all sorts of things, not just in conception, but, you know, it involves having a cleansing diet for a while, lots of mung beans, some digestive herbs, such as things like we might use guduchi, triphala, Trikatu, which is the 3 spices, various sort of herbs which help clear the body of any loosely called toxins we call armor. So then you do that, and then you start to take some ghee. So over a few days, you take ghee in the morning and you build that amount until your body's almost saturated with it. Your stools are starting to look a bit oily. Your skin is starting to feel oily. Like, your body is really saturated. So basically the idea is that it goes into all of into all of the cells in the body and helps with any of those oil soluble things that need to be removed from the body. And then the idea it brings it all into the gut, into the digestive system. Then you take some purgative and then you basically have up to 30 bowel movements of a day. That's the sort of extreme case. It could be 10, but it's, you know, quite a lot. And then you gradually recover after. So that's a very specific Ayurvedic treatment that you use for helping, especially with pitta reduction. But it's useful in lots of areas. I use that quite a lot, actually.
And what sort of purgatives would you use?
So I've tried various different ones, but the one I find is most useful is something called Trivrit Leham. So Trivrit is quite a strong, has quite a strong purgative effect, but it's made into a leham, which is basically a jam. And so it's cooked alongside ghee and other herbs. And there's also jaggery often goes in, or honey. Honey is added later on. And you kind of end up with this sort of brown, black, sticky jam. It's actually quite tasty. And that's what we use. And the idea with that is not have you only if you've got the Trivrit in there, but you've also got other herbs which help to settle the digestive system, so you're not getting all the cramps and kind of some of the discomfort that comes with the purging. So it manages that, and it's got, you know, quite a lot of herbs in there to help with that. If you just use the Trivrit itself, you end up with it just being more uncomfortable, which you can avoid.
So it seems like quite a lot of Ayurvedic herbal treatments rely on kind of the taste of the herbs and the taste of foods and the qualities, but there's been quite a lot of people using Ayurvedic herbs, but say using them in capsule form, for example. How do you feel about that, and does that detract from the effect that you're getting?
I think it can. I mean, I do give capsules to some of my clients because they just can't take the powders, and I think you're still getting quite a lot of the effects on the system. So there's different ways. We see the taste is really important, but then we also have the virya, which is the potency, whether it's hot or cold, and then we've also got the vipaka, which is the post-digestive effect, which those are going to happen. Those last two are going to happen either way, and even the taste, it's still being experienced in the body. But I think adding the taste, the actual being really aware and conscious of the taste, does help. And I do encourage my clients to have powders if they can. But yes, it's not always possible. And there is one, particularly Carl Omega Andrographis, which I know is used across different places, which is deeply bitter. It's pretty strong. So I don't insist on people taking that as powder. But they, having that as capsules, still get lots of benefit from it. But yeah, and I think, but understanding herbs in terms of taste is just really useful. And as you say, foods, just what effect is this going to have on my body? So like even coming back to pregnancy, for example, wanting to increase that kapha at the beginning and nourish you, you'd want to be having tastes which do that. So things like the sweet taste, and I'm not talking about refined sugar, but sweet taste like carbohydrates, like grains and sweet root vegetables and things like that. So not even extreme ends of it. But those are going to be all sort of building, nourishing foods, and the taste itself is telling you that. And that we have the same thing with some herbs. So for example, shatavari, which I think has become, again, quite used throughout the community, that has a sweet, a sweet effect and a sweet taste, as well as others, which helps with that sort of building, nourishing effect.
When I was at Pucker, we worked on some research with the University of Exeter, and they found that shatavari was helpful for building muscle, which kind of goes towards this sweet building effect of it, I guess.
Hi there, Sebastian here. If you're enjoying this episode, you might like to know there are plenty more herbal insights on our website. Come and discover more on the science, tradition, and practical use of herbs at herbalreality.com. You can check out our special features, such as our herb library, where we have monographs written by clinical practitioners on over 200 herbs used in Western, Chinese, and Ayurvedic herbal traditions. We cover the traditional use, modern research, how practitioners use the herbs in clinic, any quality and safety data, as well as a sustainability listening, so you know how to safely use the best quality herbs in a way that protects your health and that of the planet. You can search herbs by the action, grouping them all together, say for immunity or by energetic function, all the immunological, heating or cooling herbs in one place. You can also sign up for our newsletter for plant-powered wisdom delivered straight to your inbox for the most up-to-date information. Right, let's get back to today's conversation.
Touching on shatavari, but also particularly herbs like ashwagandha have had like a huge increase in interest and people using them a lot, particularly, I think, in perimenopause. It's quite a popular herb for that. But a lot of the people who are using these herbs are using them without any understanding of Ayurveda or necessarily thinking about the Ayurvedic principles of diagnosis or prescribing. Is that a problem, or is it being used in ways that aren't appropriate?
Yes, I do think. I think it is a bit of a problem. So from when we look at a herb from an Ayurvedic point of view, we're looking at obviously the qualities of the herb, the actions of the herb, but we're also looking at the what's going on with the client from a really broad and holistic point of view. So, you know, if they've come with, say, fertility issues, I'm going to be also really interested in what their digestion is doing. Mm-hmm. And therefore, can you actually assimilate and take in these herbs? Can you deal with them? And so I would be, you know, for example, ashwagandha is a really good one to talk about on this front, because ashwagandha is quite a heavy to digest herb. It's wonderful, got so many useful things with it, but it's quite heavy to digest. And so therefore, if your digestion is weak and you have ama, which is the sort of toxic buildup in the body and in the digestive system, then you're going to actually worsen that situation, which means that, yes, you're taking the ashwagandha, but actually you're sort of blocking up your digestive system even more, and then you're not getting the benefits of it either. Whereas if I was seeing that person, I'd say, okay, let's just hold on the ashwagandha for a little bit, not for, you know, you can still take it, but let's just really get your digestive fire working well with some maybe pungent herbs, bitter herbs, depending on what they need. Get that working well, and then let's move on to something like ashwagandha, or even shatavari is a similar sort of thing, so that then they can really assimilate it and use it really well in the body. So I think, you know, this kind of universal, well, ashwagandha is good for you, everyone should take it, I definitely disagree. And it also increases pitta, so it's really good for reducing vata, the air element, and kapha, the water and earth element, but it actually is a bit pitta increasing. So if someone's got a lot of pitta, so for example, they've, you know, maybe got some like lots of skin rashes coming up or burning in their digestive system or things like that, then I would be like, again, no, let's not go for the ashwagandha. There are some other really good herbs like shatavari or other herbs which would be better. So I think it is really important to look at all the factors. And if you are self-prescribing, at least really look up, you know, if it's an Ayurvedic herb, like, well, how is it traditionally used? Because I think there is no such thing as just, oh, this herb is good for you. Depends on your constitution and your imbalance and your state of your digestion and all of that thing, sort of thing, which I think, you know, you can come to understand about yourself. So my work with the Ayurveda Academy, we help people to really understand, what is my constitution? We have a quiz that people can do on the website, but like, what is my constitution? What are my imbalances? And then like, help people to really kind of explore what might be useful for me. We don't teach people about medicinal herbs, but people could then start to at least understand, well, okay, why this might not be so appropriate for me and why it might be. So I think people can develop that themselves, but I think with things that get a bit more complex, you probably would want to see a practitioner.
Yeah, absolutely. I think fully agree with that. Particularly interesting if ashwagandha is being taken by a lot of perimenopausal women with hot flushes, for example, which presumably must be a pitta driven.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And while ashwagandha is brilliant for the vata aspect, which a lot of people will have during perimenopause, you know, you might then be adding fire to fire literally by adding the ashwagandha. So you might not be ideal.
Yeah. Interesting. And are there... certain symptoms and signs can indicate that a particular dosha or quality is out of whack. Are there specific? Can you link that to specific conditions? For example, say endometriosis or polycystic ovary syndrome, things that impact on fertility. Can you look at them in terms of what is their dosha makeup?
With some, but even, you know, like it gives you some ideas, but you still then need to really understand the client, because it could be two different clients who come with polycystic ovaries where the mechanism for that happening has come from a different route. A good example, let's say with polycystic ovaries, it's often a combination of Vata and Kapha involved, but it could be that the main route through has been an increase in Kapha, which is then creating like a blocking in the body, and then the Vata gets blocked, and the Vata kind of gets like stuck, you know, like a air in a piston, you know, it's kind of like, argh! And so then you would want to really make sure that you looked at the Kapha first, and then the Vata will naturally resolve. But it could be a completely different person who's actually just like highly Vata out of balance. You know, they've led a very Vata increasing lifestyle. They're running around everywhere all the time. They've maybe lost some weight, whatever it may be. And actually the Vata is driving it. So it's not always quite so simple as to say those like particular dosha. Although there are some things which you can often say, well, that's probably likely, less so with fertility based, because by the time you get to, or women, you know, anything to do with the reproductive system, that's the seventh tissue in a whole line of tissues that the body has produced. So we see seven tissues starting off with plasma and ending up with reproductive tissue. And so by the time you've got something kind of lodged in there, it can be a little bit of a long process that's happened. So it's less of a kind of easy, well, it's just that dosha just needs to come down a bit. It's kind of actually, how do we clear all of that? Whereas if you're looking at something more on the digestive end, you could sometimes say, well, that's clearly a Vata thing. You're constipated, nearly often there's going to be Vata involved. Or you've got burning sensation in your stomach. Okay, well, Pitta is really likely to be involved, because it's much more sort of earlier on in the disease process. It's more something that the you can sort of tell the doshas quite more easily from.
So it sounds like reproductive health is the most complicated thing to try and fix, as it were.
It can be, yeah. And a lot of Ayurveda is focused on reproductive health. I mean, that was one of the big aims of Ayurveda, is to create healthy progeny. So, you know, a huge chapters of in the texts are about how to take herbs and to nourish the tissue so that you have healthy reproductive tissue. So there's a lot of support in the text about it, but it's also, it can be more complex and take a little longer. And which is why I was saying about my case, you know, sometimes it's like, look, I could just give you some herbs for you know, a few months and let's see. But it's like, well, if you really want to go for this, I think actually let's go in heavier, because it's a bit of a longer process, and it's a bit of a little more tissues to jump through before we get the results that we want.
And so really unpicking this and untangling it all, does that involve just a really good case history and kind of trying to work out what someone was born with, their constitution, and then how that's evolved over time? And presumably it takes quite a long time to pick up all that information and detail.
Yeah, I mean, my initial consultation with someone is an hour and a half. So I go into all sorts of things. I do warn them up front, you know, we're going to be talking about things that you might think are totally irrelevant. Like, why is she asking me about, you know, about my emotions when I'm actually just talking about my, you know, my gut? Or although obviously nowadays people are beginning to see that connection a lot more. But yeah, all sorts of history taking, understanding what people are like from when they were younger, that you can use some forms as well to help with that, you know, try and get some of the knowledge in before you spend that time. And I mean, some practitioners will use pulse diagnosis and tongue diagnosis as well. I do a bit, some of that as well, but it depends on your level of experience with it. But you can get all the information through history taking and just being really observant and maybe, you know, touching the client, feeling the temperature, for example, of their skin, or but not necessarily having to pulse read. I think that's something that people think is an essential part of Ayurveda, but actually when you do an Ayurveda degree, you're really not taught much of that at all. So all my knowledge of that has come post degree, you know, in terms of lineages and learning that sort of thing. So but it's not essential, but it does add in. It's just another bit of data, you know, as you say, there's a lot.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think I read that pulse taking and tongue diagnosis and things like that might have come from Unani medicine and sort of been interwoven into Ayurvedic practice as well. And Western herbal medicine's constantly evolving as a tradition, and kind of you combine empirical knowledge with modern scientific evidence. How's the practice of Ayurveda changed over time, you know, over a long period of time, and then also maybe since you've been studying?
I mean, you know, it is 5,000 years old, so I suppose there's been a lot of evolution, but even that, we're still using texts that were written, you know, probably written down a few thousand years ago. And I think it's a bit of an interesting one where, you know, the only things that we firmly say, like, this is Ayurvedic knowledge, are in the text. So, like, that's the kind of go-to. And when we teach, you know, I'm particularly, like, the nerdy one who's like, hang on, let's check the text. You know, I want to go back, make sure it's written there. So in some way, some things haven't changed. But, of course, you know, we're eating things now which weren't written about in the text. So we do have to start applying some sort of trying to work stuff out. But I think when we do that, we do need to put a little, you know, proviso. Well, listen, this is what we think. You know, this is not sort of Ayurvedic law that this is the case. And I think that's where a lot of stuff comes in with Ayurveda, with a lot of the popular Ayurveda, is, well, this is Ayurveda. It's like, well, you know, let's just be careful about what we're saying is Ayurveda and isn't Ayurveda. But so I suppose in a way we have to evolve, like you were saying. We have to start applying it into our modern lifestyles and say, like, okay, what does being on a phone do to you? Well, that wasn't written about in the Ayurvedic text, but we can just assume, okay, what does it do to my body when I'm on my phone? My mind might start to race, my eyes are moving around a lot, all those things. Well, these are all vata characteristics, so therefore it's likely that being on a phone is going to increase my vata. So it's applying that, but I suppose it's with some humility that we are just there's probably a better word for that, but we're surmising, we're working it out. So that's changed, and since I've been involved with Ayurveda, which is, you know, over 20 years, it's definitely grown in popularity. There's probably a lot more out there in terms of Ayurveda, but there's also a lot more myths out there that have been perpetuated. So, you know, we're always on a little bit of a crusade to sort of, like, you know, say that these are just myths, they're not actually true. I think, and the link with yoga, I think, is, you know, is important, has probably will always have been there. And I think it's great that, you know, people are getting into yoga and therefore Ayurveda, and probably the other way around, but less so.
Yeah, it does feel like yoga was sort of first in the popularity contest, and then inspired people to think about Ayurveda separately as well. Yeah. Do you use any Western herbs, and can you kind of apply Ayurvedic principles to kind of Western? Obviously, you have to apply that Ayurvedic principles to Western diets, because we're not all eating what would traditionally be eaten when Ayurveda was sort of first began. But are there any Western herbs that you use?
I do. I think it's really important to try as much as possible and use herbs from our local environment. So I do use both. And in Ayurveda, it always says that, you know, depending on the land you live in, you do need to use different things. You have to different diet, different herbs, and use the things around you. So I do that. I mean, I use things like, chamomile has been mentioned in the ancient texts as well, but things like lady's mantle, for example, or elecampane. So a few herbs which I've been inspired to use, because actually there have been some fantastic herbalists who've been using Ayurveda and to apply that to the Western herbs, like people like Anne McIntyre and Sebastian Pohl, and like they've created their, you know, some really useful references for that. Again, it's all based on observation and feeling what happens in the body, so you know it will be interpretation, but I find that really useful and inspiring. It's just lovely to know that, you know, like someone like nettle, for example, you can go and pick, or just at least knowing that they're kind of grown a bit closer to home is useful. And so yeah, you can just take any Western herb and say, okay, what taste does this have? What potency is it likely to have? What's the post-digestive taste going to be? And use it in the same way. So, for example, lady's mantle, I would use if I'm trying to reduce pitta or kapha, but not if someone's got high vata, because that's just, you know, that's the understanding that these, that's how it works from an Ayurvedic point of view. So I'd be using it maybe slightly differently, but some of the actions on the body are obviously, you know, those are kind of there, you know, so elecampane may be useful for lungs, for example, but I would use that only for certain people with lung issues rather than everyone with lung issues.
And nettle, I'm just going to quiz you on all the different herbs that we're familiar with.
Yeah, I don't have nettle in my pharmacy here. I just know, you know, it obviously grows around. But I will just tell people to have nettle tea, for example. Again, pitta kapha reducing. So a lot of these, that's interesting. A lot of these Western herbs do seem to be more on that front. Again, not for high vata. Well, it's got a bitter taste. A lot of these sort of more bitter tasting herbs nearly always will be vata increasing. I'm just wondering now whether there is some sort of thing. Oh, most Western herbs vata increasing. I don't know. I'll have to go back and do some research on that. It's interesting. Yeah. All the ones I've mentioned, I'm like, oh yeah.
Is it that we've evolved with these herbs and therefore they suit the constitution of the people who live around them, or do they reflect the environment that they were grown in? So.
Well, that, I mean, I think that is important. We do live in what we call in Ayurveda Anupadesha, which is a wet, damp land. So the UK is that. And so you would want kapha reducing herbs quite a lot of the time. Pitta, not so much, I guess. But, you know, we don't live in a dry climate, which is where vata would increase. Whereas things may be growing in the Arizona desert, you might find that they more naturally have a vata reduction quality to them. Obviously, now we need vata reducing herbs because our lifestyles are completely bonkers, and we need it. But actually, maybe traditionally, in us living in really damp conditions, it wouldn't have been so much of an issue.
Could be interesting. What are some daily practices you would recommend for all women to improve their overall health and well-being day by day?
Day by day. I mean, some of them are just classic sort of Ayurvedic ones. I mean, my big one that I think is so important is waking up in the morning and drinking a good volume of warm water. So essential, gets the bowels moving, rehydrates you really quickly, and it's, you know, it's said in Ayurveda you can live to 100 if you do that every day. That was the aim of Ayurveda, is to help you live healthily to 100. So that's a big one. I think particularly for women, things like we do love an oil massage in Ayurveda. And so that would be either with, say, sesame oil with herbs in it, or just sesame oil or coconut oil if you've got a lot of pitta. So a daily, if you can, doesn't have to be some elaborate massage, but at least just applying the oils to your body. But for women, really including the breasts is really important. So really helping that the circulation of the rasa dhatu, the lymph and plasma tissue in the breast, so that they're not stagnating, not getting painful breasts, for example, lumps and bumps and all those kind of things. So definitely, if you are self-massaging, increase, you know, really, and it could be quite vigorous about it as well, just to really make sure that that's getting good circulation and good movement of the lymph in your breasts. I definitely used to suffer more from breast tenderness, and when I do that massage, it doesn't happen. So that's really useful. And oil, I mean, oil in all sorts of orifices is good in Ayurveda. So, you know, that could be the nose, that could be the ears, but also in the vagina as well. Thinking about women, you know, particularly perimenopausal women, but also if you're trying to conceive, using either a ghee-based medication, or it could be sesame oil based as well. Like Satavari ghee, for example, is a really fantastic one that you can actually apply in the vagina, and it really helps the lubrication and also helps with just nourishing the tissues there. So that's a useful one as well.
And how would that change during pregnancy? Are there any specific things that you advise people to do during pregnancy?
So we talked about the first few months where you're really kind of trying to nourish and ghee and milk and all that kind of thing. And then gradually as time goes on, actually there's quite a lot of advice about having meat soup. So I think a lot of people think that Ayurveda is vegetarian science, but actually meat is used medicinally. So are starting to have, especially when the baby's developing more muscle and you need more muscle as you get starting to carry a heavier baby, having meat soups, not like big lumps of steak, but actually well-cooked, really tender, soupy casserole type things. That's seen as, you know, really a really important part of pregnancy. And there's a lovely bit when you get into the sort of towards the fourth month, where there's talked about this situation where you've got two hearts. So it's the baby's heart and your heart. And so there's the cravings that you start to experience are actually the cravings of the baby. So you should listen to them. And therefore you can then supply what the baby's asking for you. I would say on that, just like if you are craving lots and lots of sweet, don't go for like the chocolate, go for, okay, what it's telling me is that I need more carbohydrates. So going for that rather than, oh, no, the baby wants chocolate, which may or may not be the case.
I can distinctly remember claiming that the baby needed some ice cream at some point and using it as an excuse to get someone to get me some.
And with my first pregnancy, I went off all green vegetables completely. I couldn't have a single green vegetable in sight. I wanted like pies and chips, you know, really stodgy, which actually makes sense when we're talking about increasing kapha. And I was already quite vata, you know, we don't need to be adding lots more bitterness into the diet. And obviously it came back, but those first 3 months, like, no bitter, please. I'm not having any of it.
It seems like a lot of Ayurveda is about listening to what's going on and being really mindful about your body and your environment and sort of reacting accordingly.
Yeah, and the earlier that you can react, the better. That's really, really key. So if you wake up one morning feeling a bit bloated, react on it straight away. So that you can reverse it. So there's six stages of disease. That first little bloat or little sense of heaviness, that's like act on it, do the things you need to undo that. So maybe it means not eating for a bit or drinking some water, whatever it feels, you know, is the right in that position. And then you can reverse it really quickly so it doesn't then progress on. So yeah, that listening to your body is just so important in Ayurveda.
Well, we're coming to the end of our chat. It's been really lovely talking to you. I'd like to ask you one more question to leave our listeners with something. What do you think is the best way that women can empower themselves to have better health?
Actually, you know, one thing we haven't talked about, which I think is really, really important, is rest. I see a lot of perimenopausal women, but even women when they're younger, I think we do not allow ourselves to rest. We have this sense that we should be busy and active at all times, and actually to rest, particularly during certain parts of the cycle, you know, that bleeding time, that is so useful. And to really explain it to your husband, your partner, your friends, whatever, just saying, this is important for my health, and I'm going to be on 200% when I get back into the kapha stage, so don't worry, you know, but I am going to take that rest. And so I think as women, I feel like we've got a lot of rest to reclaim, and that's one thing I would say.
Sounds like great advice. Thank you very much. Really lovely talking to you, Kate.
And to you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. We hope today's conversation has planted a seed of inspiration and deepened your understanding of herbal medicine, and even answered a question or two. Please do subscribe to Herbcast wherever you're listening to this right now, and you'll be sure to never miss an episode. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and share it with someone who'd enjoy it too. As they say, learn something, teach something. It really helps us to reach more people and spread the good herbal world. You can also use a podcast review to share your comments and feedback about Herbcast, or perhaps make a suggestion for a future episode. It's always great to hear your views. If you can't wait till the next episode, you'll find plenty more herbal insights and all the previous Herbcast episodes on our website, and of course on social media. All the links you need are in the episode show notes. Until next time, take care, and thanks again for joining us for another episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. Bye for now.